You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of February 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. In the next 60 minutes, we'll be asking whether China's economy is running out of steam and speaking to a runner who's undertaking an audacious marathon. He's running from pole to pole for charity. And we've heard much about smart drugs. Today, I'll be speaking to one academic who says the regulations surrounding them need a rethink. And I'll be joined by Santiago Taditi, who'll give us a preview of Monocle's Section E this week. And we head to our local cafe for this week's Meet the Neighbours. All that plus some carefully curated music in the next hour on Midori House with me, Christian Yeo. But before that, we'll get the news from around the world with Louise Banbury.
Monocle 24 News with Louise Banbury. At least 28 people have been killed in two bomb attacks in Syria's second city of Aleppo. State television has blamed terrorist attacks for the blasts, which targeted security force compounds. Outside Homs, the Free Syrian Army says as many as 10,000 government troops have been deployed and villages are being abandoned ahead of an anticipated major offensive by government forces. Activist Danny has been on the streets of Homs reporting for his blogging website.
There was another rocket landing over there. See, this is happening every day. This is happening. Where's the UN? Where's the humanity? Where's America? Isn't America supposed to defend the humanity? Isn't the UN supposed to defend the humanity? Are we animals dying here? Are we supposed to live like this our whole lives?
Greece's Deputy Foreign Minister Marilizo Xenagiannakopoulou has resigned over an unpopular bailout package. The move follows similar resignations by the Socialist Deputy Labour Minister and four far-right ministers and comes amid angry protests in Athens. The last-minute bailout deal includes €3 billion worth of cuts, but Eurozone finance ministers say it's still not enough. Greece now has less than a week to meet three conditions in return for €130 billion in aid. Thousands of Egyptians marched to the Defence Ministry today to press for demands for the generals to hand over power. The protest took place before a strike called to mark the first anniversary of President Hosni Mubarak's fall. Egypt remains in political turmoil a year after a military council took over from Mubarak. Brazil is preparing to deploy troops on the streets of Rio de Janeiro as a strike by the state's police force threatened to disrupt upcoming carnival festivities. The strike for higher wages began early today and follows an ongoing walkout by police in the northeastern state of Bahia. There, police stopped working on January the 31st, unleashing a crime wave with more than 150 murders, looting and vandalism, mostly concentrated in the state capital, Salvador. Civil Police Inspector Francisco Chao said the strike was designed to put the spotlight on the challenges facing the police.
The society has the right to complain about problems that we have in the city's public security. But we need for once to stop discussing the problem's consequences and debate the causes of these problems.
Ugandan legislator David Bahati has backtracked on a controversial parliament bill that calls for the death penalty for gays. The bill outlawing homosexuality caused an international storm when it first came up in parliament last year. The legislator was later dropped, but the controversy re-emerged this week when Bahati, a ruling party member of parliament, resurrected the bill. He said today that the clause proposing the death penalty for repeat offenders would be scrapped. Julie Pepe, the spokesperson for Uganda's LGBT community, said it was a shame that other more important legislation was not being discussed.
I was in Parliament and it was traumatizing, really traumatizing. I'm disappointed that amidst so many other issues that are pressing in Uganda, that a bill like this would come up.
And scientists searching for treatments for Alzheimer's say they've made a promising discovery. Tests in the United States show a skin cancer drug can reverse symptoms of the disease when used on mice, but it will be years before we know if it works on humans. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Louise. Now let's get a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffanecker.
The weather. In association with Kuoni Travel. Here's Europe and We End the Business Week with more fierce Arctic weather in Italy and across the Adriatic. To the Balkans, a winter storm will last here all weekend, possibly into Monday, and paralysing snow inland, but closer to the coast, heavy flooding rains and high winds. We've also had some snow and ice here in the UK in the last 24 hours. The weekend is looking much sunnier though. And in Europe, the lowest temperatures this weekend will be across Belarus and Ukraine, around minus 15 by day, and as low as minus 30 degrees or even lower in some rural spots at night. Here's the weekend city outlook. In London, plus one and sunny. In Zurich, minus six and cloudy. In Milan, minus one with some snow flurries. And if you're in Moscow, 15 below, snow flurries here as well. North America now. The eastern seaboard of the US will be getting a rain and snow mix this weekend. From Chicago to New York State and New England, we're talking snow. At the southeast of the US, so Florida, thunderstorms here. But the rest of the US and Canada looking fairly quiet. Here's the weekend city outlook. In Toronto, minus eight, some snow flurries here. In Chicago, it's minus five with snow. Boston, around zero, also a bit of snow, but in Miami, 25 with tropical thunderstorms. Other world destinations now, Saturday and Sunday. In South America, Rio and Sao Paulo, both very cloudy this weekend. Heavy thunderstorms are likely, and highs will range between 25 and 30 degrees, depending on the rainstorm. In South Africa and Cape Town, a disappointingly cool and cloudy weekend with some rain, only 20 degrees. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Tomash. It's 6 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 lagert ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ja ook zo.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle
24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, the industrial powerhouse, that is China, is showing signs of stalling. Trade activity fell in January compared to the same month last year. Both imports and exports dropped. The slowdown's being blamed on problems overseas and weakening domestic market. So is China finally facing its own financial crisis? Joining me on the line now is Kerry Brown, the head of the Asia programme at Chatham House. Kerry, thank you for joining us. Firstly, did anybody see these problems in China coming?
I think they've always had a little bit of anxiety about the impact of the Eurozone crisis in China, and last year they were very keen that the Eurozone sorted its problems out. Obviously that's not entirely happened according to plan, and I think the sorts of impacts it's having on the Chinese economy now in terms of, I mean, export markets drying up a bit, and also a kind of greater anxiety in the global markets generally, I mean, that's naturally having an impact in China. And I think what it underlines is that the Chinese economy is very, very interlinked to the global economy, but particularly to the European Union, because that's, you know, the Eurozone, the European economy is the world's largest single economic entity.
Yes, is it arguably too exposed to the Eurozone problems?
Well, it's had a strategy in place over the last sort of year or so of trying to sort of, you know, I mean, primarily kind of stimulate domestic consumption so that, in a sense, it's more autonomous. The economy of China is more autonomous. Domestic consumption is, you know, a third of GDP. In most other countries, it's about sort of a half or two-thirds. So it's very low. So, I mean, part of the kind of Chinese government strategy has been to try and stimulate Chinese people themselves to sort of buy more and be more economically active.
Could it ultimately be self-sufficient, though? Surely it will still need export and import to survive and grow.
Oh, yes. I mean, it wants a more mixed economy. I mean, I think at the moment it feels it's more reliant on exports than it should be, and the kind of strategy in the last few years has been to try and, you know, pull back from that and also to diversify the places that it exports to. But at the end of the day, it's still a massive exporter.
What are some of those regions that China could now engage with?
Other developing markets like Africa, I mean, the Middle East, it's beginning to do more trade with. Certainly Latin America, it's built up big trade links. What it's done is actually signed a lot of free trade agreements across the world. And in fact, in Asia itself, it's signed a free trade agreement with the ASEAN 10 countries and also with Japan and with Taiwan.
Looking back on the internal problems with consumption and the consumer market slowing down, are the Chinese by nature less frivolous and more frugal by nature compared to the West?
On the whole, they save. They've got about $2 trillion US in low-yield current accounts, savings accounts. And so, you know, the reason why is because mostly in China there's, you know, expenses for healthcare, expenses for education. It's not like these are sort of state-provided. The social welfare system in China is pretty patchy. And so middle classes on the whole are always saving for a rainy day. They're always kind of quite anxious, and that accounts for these sort of big savings rates.
Could we likely see such a change in the culture there to engage with consumers and spark growth again, like we see in the US and Europe?
There's a dislike amongst Chinese consumers of taking on any kinds of debt. So credit cards, the kinds of big debts that we saw, you know, personal expenditure built up in the US and the European Union, I think that would be very unlikely. I mean, there's a sort of dislike of that. But I think there'll be a bit more of people being willing to kind of spend on, you know, kind of not just luxuries, but things that, you know, they kind of have been spending in the West, particularly cars. I mean, China is now the world's biggest car market. And so electrical appliances, things like that, computers, they'll almost certainly always have a really good market in China.
Do you think the Chinese authorities, Beijing, needs to loosen its tight hold on foreign companies operating within the land?
It's a pretty open environment. There's some protected sectors, but on the whole, there are a lot of multinationals operating in China. I mean, one of the battles really is that there's this problem of certain access, you know, financial services and others, where, you know, foreign companies really want to move into the Chinese market, but there are kind of, you know, there are sort of rules against them in a way. And so, you know, this is the sort of thing that certainly the European Union has got a big kind of interest in. The European Chamber of Commerce every year produces a very good report on, you know, lack of market access for these key sectors. In a lot of other sectors, it's a pretty open market.
Are we seeing other similar problems in some of the other BRIC countries? What about India and Brazil and Russia even? How are their economies faring? Looking at the BRIC countries as the answer to the problems that the world is facing, the West suffering, but the BRICS moving things forward. What's happening elsewhere? Is it as bad there?
Well, India's growth rate is slightly below China's. China's, I think, was something like 9% last year, and India's about 6%. But it's got plenty. I mean, it's a smaller economy than China, about a third the size of China. But I think the aspiration of Indians is one day that they're going to really compete with China because they've got lots of great assets. I mean, they've got, you know, obviously kind of lots of manpower, but also, you know, sort of plenty of technology that they're able to use. I think with Russia, you know, growth there is always going to be built on, you know, an incredible sort of natural resources of the country. Brazil has seen very strong growth rates too. I think the story really is that emerging markets and sort of those, you know, developing markets are going to be the source of growth for the future.
Do they all have an equal appetite for consumer goods? Or, I mean, from an outsider's perspective, India seems to have a stronger hunger and appetite for consumer goods than, say, China does.
Yes, I mean, India has a lot of poverty, though. I mean, China, you're probably talking about a middle class of 200 million, maybe. I mean, it's difficult to assess, but, you know, those are the people that I think foreign companies are trying to sell to, and Chinese companies. Brazil, it's sort of slightly different. You know, I mean, the numbers that you're talking about and the kind of appetite they have for buying goods that the West wants to sell them, it varies a great deal. I mean, I think in China, you have incredible strength for some luxury goods like Bentley. I mean, they sell a huge amount of their goods there, their cars there. I mean, Louis Vuitton, I think it's, well, you know, their biggest market. But you have this kind of sense that, you know, for instance, the UK, our strongest sectors are financial services, and we just don't seem to sort of really be able to crack this one. It's not easy. For India, I think you've got a lot more entrenched poverty. I mean, you know, real kind of issues, maybe a kind of elite of, you know, a business elite of a few million, but it's a much smaller market.
Certainly more of a divide as well, as you say. Going back to China lastly, Kerry, how long will these problems continue? Everybody's looking to China for exponential growth and carry the world forward. Everybody's trying to strike deals with the Chinese. Will it get worse before it gets better? And what sort of time frame are we talking?
I think the International Monetary Fund said this year that China's growth would be lower than expected, but only by a percentage point. I mean, the expectation really is that over the next 5 years, at least, China will see pretty strong growth. I mean, 7 to 8%, and the rest of the world, developed world anyway, will, you know, pretty much sort of die for that. You know, I mean, it's a good sort of strong rate. Afterwards, who knows? I mean, the trajectory really is that once you meet, you know, sort of middle income per capita status of about $8,000 US a person, you know, you kind of see sort of these rates become more like 5-4%, and there we're into a sort of very different ball game. At the moment, though, there's plenty of space for growth in the Chinese economy.
Kerry, thank you. That was Kerry Brown from Chatham House. Now it's time for a song on Midori House. This is Grimes with the song Oblivion. That was Grimes with Oblivion. It's coming up to 19 minutes past the hour here at Midori House. In just a moment, we'll be speaking to someone who's running from pole to pole to raise money for the Red Cross. We'll be back after this.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance. The Globalist bids good night to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia, with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run-through of the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
There's a lot of money in this country. It's a very strong economy, and it's really growing rapidly, and so it's the natural choice.
Wake up in Europe to The Globalist, live every weekday at 6 a.m. London time, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, our next guest is a runner with multiple world records for endurance running, and his latest feat is no different. It'd make most people run the other way. Pat Farmer has set himself quite a goal. He wants to run from the North Pole to the South Pole. That's a distance of around 12,500 miles. We can speak to Pat now. He's on the phone with us. Firstly, Pat, are you still running at the moment?
G'day, Christian. Yeah, I am. I'm just walking along the road at the moment. I'm about 100 kilometres north of a place called Rio Gallegos, which is just near Tierra del Fuego, near the southern end of Argentina, on my way to Ushuaia, which will be the finish.
OK, so slow your pace down now and catch your breath, because I'm dying to know why you're doing this, firstly.
Well, this is a promotion for the International Red Cross. I'm trying to bring clean water and clean sanitary conditions to people around the world that simply don't have that. And we've already built one well in Timor during the course of this run. So that's helped around 4,500 people with a school, a medical centre and the village there that is now relying on that fresh water.
So how long left do you think you have on this run?
Well, the total distance, I don't know exactly, but it's pretty close to about 20,800 kilometres. That's because I've zigzagged across the Americas a fair bit. The total distance from one end of the Earth through to the other is around 21,000 kilometres. I've got about 9 days left on this journey, and I've covered 20,119 kilometres to this point.
Is it as bad as it sounds? In my opinion, it sounds horrific. I don't know how you do it.
Look, it is. It is. There's no two ways about it there. I've been travelling since the 6th of April. I was dropped off by a Russian helicopter in the North Pole and from there made my way out across the ice, across broken ice. That's the Arctic Ocean and up over compressed ice. Some of it being as high as a three-storey building, dragging a 100-kilogram sled as I did so. But there has not been one easy day on this whole journey. And, of course, blisters, bruises, aches and pains are all part and parcel of the event. But thank God it's coming to an end.
How do you prepare your body for this? Or is that impossible?
Well, it's almost impossible. It's really the sum of everything that I've done in my life prior to this. So that is basically I've done two runs across America from California to New York in the Transamerica Foot Race. I've raced around the whole of Australia from for the Centenary Federation there. That was covering nearly 15,000 kilometres. I've raced in Europe, Asia, and numerous races back home in Australia, of course. So it's really the sum of all of that. I did train dragging tyres. Some of your listeners might be familiar with Bondi Beach in Sydney, dragging tyres around there, much to the amusement of many of the onlookers, trying to get used to dragging a sled.
And is it the same?
No. No, not at all.
Pat, what drives you? What keeps you going on these low days? You say every day's a struggle. What makes you carry on?
Look, I was very fortunate. I've travelled a lot of the world. I've seen places like Egypt, India, Nepal, Peru, and of course some of the islands like Samoa and Timor. And I've seen firsthand people that suffer from absolute poverty. So for me, all of this will come to an end in approximately 10 and a half months. But for a lot of people in the world, their life is like this every day, and they get up and they just have to go through the same grind again. And the fact that they battle for shelter, for food, and for clean drinking water is just a terrible thing in the times that we live in these days. So I wanted to do something about that.
And along the way, have you taken in some quite impressive sights, I would imagine, things that you wouldn't ordinarily see as a tourist?
Oh, absolutely. Look, I've been very, very close to the volcanoes. One of them close to active there through Ecuador. Some of the sights I saw in Mexico were amazing. There was things like a black bear crossed the path in front of me, only about 10 metres away from in front of me up there in Canada, in far northern Canada. Yeah, I've seen all sorts of wildlife, from armadillos to skunks to llama to incredible people that have dropped and dropped off on the side of the road and given me food and just wanted to offer me shelter or wanted to do anything they possibly could to help me. It really opens people's eyes, and it certainly opened my own eyes to the milk of human kindness. When people see you pushing yourself to a limit for somebody else, they can't help but be affected.
You talk about going past volcanoes, the terrain that you're crossing and the mileage you're clocking up. You must have got through about 10 pairs of shoes.
Oh, more than that. Actually, I've been through 21 pairs of shoes so far, one pair of snowshoes and one pair of Baffin boots. The boots I wore through the Darien jungle, trudging through mud, and I've already done the South Pole. This is might sound a little strange to you, but I was in Chile and I got called in by the company that was flying me into the South Pole, and they said, "You've got to come here now. The weather's closing in. If you don't get across to the South Pole now, you're not going to be able to do it this season." So I actually flew ahead, did the South Pole from Union Glacier, a distance of 1,200 kilometres from there, past Hercules Inlet and on into the South Pole, and then came back to where I left the road, and I've continued on from there. And that's why, for me, the finish is at Ushuaia.
Pat, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. I'm so glad that you could take the time along your walk to speak to us. All the best. And if you're brave enough to do another one, we'd love to speak to you on your next venture. That was Pat Farmer, who's embarking on a vast run from the north to the South Pole, speaking to us on Midori House. It's time for some music now. This is Saint-Étienne and Hug My Soul. Was Saint-Étienne and Hug My Soul. Coming up in the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be speaking to our Section E editor, Santiago Taditi, about what caught his eye. We'll also be talking about whether smart drugs can live up to the hype. But first, here's Louise Bambury with the news headlines.
Thanks, Christian. At least 28 people have been killed in two bomb attacks in Syria's second city of Aleppo. State television has blamed terrorist attacks for the blasts, which targeted security force compounds. There's been heavy gunfire in the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli after a demonstration against the Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad. Greece's deputy foreign minister has resigned over an unpopular bailout package. She's the sixth senior politician to quit over the deal, which was agreed last night. Thousands of Egyptians marched to the defence ministry to demand the generals hand over power a day before the first anniversary of the fall of President Hosni Mubarak. The Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab, which controls much of Somalia, has released a joint video with Al-Qaeda announcing that the two groups have merged. Brazil is preparing to deploy troops on the streets of Rio de Janeiro as a strike by the state's police force threatened to disrupt upcoming carnival festivities. Ugandan legislator David Bahati has backtracked on a controversial anti-homosexuality bill, saying that a clause calling for the death penalty for repeat offenders would be scrapped. And scientists in the United States have made a promising discovery that a skin cancer drug can reverse symptoms of Alzheimer's when used on mice. And those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
I'm joined now by Santiago Taditi to talk about Monocle's Section E this week. Hello, Santiago.
Hi, how are you, Chris?
I'm very well. Now, you've got a couple of interesting leisure venues to talk about today, starting with a hotel in Palm Springs.
Yeah, well, this is the new property of the Sedell Group. It's called the Saguaro Palm Springs.
Right.
And it opened last Friday. This used to be a Holiday Inn. That closed in September last year.
Okay, a particularly nice Holiday Inn or a bit of a
plain... Well, you know, Holiday Inns are kind of standard.
Bit of an oxymoron on that.
Mm. Yeah, so the Sedell Group, as you might know, they also have the Ace Hotel, and soon they will open the Nomad Hotel.
So they're like big, ostentatious and...
No, not really. This is kind of nicely designed, okay, yet affordable and down-to-earth hotels.
But quite unique.
Very unique, yeah, exactly. So what the group did is they kept like the outer shell of the Holiday Inn, and they refurbished the interiors and they painted the walls and the rooms. And in total, there are 245 rooms on this property, and it's very colorful. I think you saw pictures earlier today of the hotel.
What would you say the theme is to all of it, to the decor?
Well, actually, I think it's the colors themselves because... Mm. The whole hotel is painted in 14 different hues, and these are inspired in wildflowers that are endemic to the Coachella Valley. So I think it's like one of those colorful spots in the middle of dry land and like a deserted area.
And it's bringing the outdoors in to
exactly
the building.
Something like that. Yeah. I think this is going to do very well, especially on the food side, because
oh, really?
They're going to have chef Jose Garces. Mm-hmm. He does the Iron Chef in the Food Network.
Oh, right.
Maybe you can recognize him on TV. And there's also going to be a tequila bar.
Oh, I like it already.
Called El Jefe.
Yeah, I'm sold.
So, yeah, that should be exciting.
Yeah, yeah. It's not an over-competitive market, Palm Springs. It's a big holiday destination, isn't it?
It's a nice place to go to catch some sun. I think this is going to be a very successful venture because in a sunny place like this, you need a place to catch the sun, and all of the rooms have a balcony, so I'm sure that they will be full.
I'll go down
all
well.
The time.
And now you're about to head off to a restaurant for the evening. You're going for dinner at a pop-up restaurant here in London.
Yeah, exactly. This is a restaurant in Islington in North London, and it's run by a guy called Pip, or he's like to be called Pip. I hope to meet him today and check out if that's his real name or not.
What's special about Pip's restaurant?
Well, what he did last year, at the end of last year during Christmas, is that he took over an old Citroën garage in North London, just off Upper Street. And together with a friend, they converted it into a barn, an urban barn. And they created this food space where they sell fresh produce and... fruit, vegetables, and so on. And in the evenings, they host dinners.
So it really is, as you call it, a food space. It's a dual-purpose food space, isn't it? During the day, it's almost a market. And
exactly.
At night, it becomes
something
a restaurant.
Like that. Yeah, something like that. So what they do is that Friday and Saturdays, at lunchtime, Pip and his colleague offer pay what you think it's worth lunch.
Oh, really?
So you go there and you have a couple of courses, and when the bill arrives, you decide how much you want to pay.
Oh, that could go horribly wrong.
Or horribly well.
It could go very well, actually. It's a reason to put effort into the kitchen, isn't it, I suppose?
I guess it all depends on the quality of food you
eat. Yeah.
And I think this is not a place for everybody. It's mostly people that are really into food, that are gourmets and foodies and are interested in good flavors. And it's this concept, I think, is just a way of showing the chef and the producers a token of appreciation. The final bill will reflect on the performance of the chef that night.
Is there much focus on the surroundings at all, or is it, like you say, about the food and the food only?
Well, I'm sure I haven't seen the surroundings yet, but
I'd be interested to see
converted garage.
Yeah, exactly. How that can work.
I've seen a couple of pictures, but I really want to go and check it out and see what it looks like, because I don't know. And at first, when I heard about this story, I thought, like, wow, who wants to eat in a garage?
Like, and there's no alcohol license. It's very much back to basics. You bring your own booze.
Exactly. Bring your own booze. That is only on Fridays. Friday during supper clubs they organize. So you get three courses for £25 and you bring whatever drinks you want.
And as it's Friday, you are taking your own booze, aren't you?
I am, yeah. I just...
What is that? It's a bottle of red.
I bought this bottle of red. I'm very much into red wine right now.
Okay, what sort?
Sweet tannin Barossa Shiraz from Australia. So this is a New World wine. And according to the label, it has a fresh, ripe, berry fruit flavor. And it's enhanced by chocolate and vanilla oak.
You don't fancy opening it now, do you?
Yeah, let's open it. Do you have a glass here?
Oh, I don't. I've only got this little saucer here. I've got a cup of tea.
That's actually a saucer. We drink wine here in the office.
We'll do it like that then.
I hope Tyler doesn't.
Yes.
I hope Tyler doesn't find
the
out
boss
that
must not be listening.
That we're drinking red wine in the studio. Here you go.
Oh, thank you very much. There we go. Mmm. Oh, that's beautiful.
Did you like it?
Oh, yeah. You're lucky taking... Off he's going to go now and have that, the full bottle at this restaurant.
I can leave you a full glass and you can...
Leave us a glass.
Yeah, why not?
Santiago, thank you ever so much. Have a good evening.
Thank you, you too.
It's time for a song now. This is Mika Snow from Sweden with Animal. Sweden's Mika Snow with Animal. In a second, we'll be hearing if you can take a pill that could make you smarter and what that might mean for society. We'll be back in a moment.
Every Saturday on The Review, Monocle's editors ditch their jackets and unbutton their top buttons for a cosy weekend look at what's selling at bookshops from Buenos Aires to Brisbane.
This store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books.
A survey of the global newsstand, some fine tracks chosen by a great music guest, and lots of good conversation. Join us every Saturday at midday London time. And remember, this show is best enjoyed with coffee while camped out on your sofa.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design hour. It's a show about the things that we live with. Join us as we take you on a tour of the finest furniture, buildings and fashion from around the world. From ramshackle warehouses to luxury runways, hard hat construction sites to the safety of the studio, we bring you the people and products that fill our lives.
these people find a common ground, and you know if they do, that you're probably onto something that everybody in the world might be able to agree with.
Tune in each week to hear about the things that make life better. That's Section D, premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. It's 45 minutes past the hour here in London. Now, last year, the film Limitless teased us with the idea of a pill that could make anything possible, a drug that gave its user limitless brain power. The thought of digesting books in seconds or learning a new language during a lunch hour might seem a little far-fetched, but pills that supposedly make us smarter are already available. But should we use them? The rise in popularity of drugs like modafinil and Ritalin amongst college students has been widely documented. The drugs themselves were designed for other purposes, like narcolepsy and attention deficit disorder. But is there any harm in taking them to boost brain power? And what ethical questions does that raise? Fresh from a speech on the subject and joining me on the line is Bennett Foddy, a director of the Programme on Ethics of the New Biosciences at Oxford University. Hello, Bennett. Firstly, do these drugs that we're talking about this evening increase intelligence? Do they boost your IQ?
I think that we have to be careful about putting it in those terms. I think that we're looking at drugs that have been around and, as you say, have been identified for other sorts of conditions. And there's been a movement lately in the scientific community to try to understand whether these drugs have an impact on cognitive abilities. But we're a million miles away from having a drug that just straightforwardly boosts your IQ or gives you mental powers you didn't previously have.
So what essentially do they do if they don't give you extra brain power?
Right. So modafinil is mainly used for narcoleptics, as you said, and for people who have shift working disorder, basically disorders that make you feel very fatigued. And it has the power, much the same as caffeine, to reverse some of the effects of feeling very fatigued, feeling very tired. And as you know, when we get very tired, our ability to think clearly declines. We make worse judgments. It's harder for us to focus. And these drugs help to reverse that. Maybe you can work a little longer. Maybe you can focus a little better. But it's not giving you a new power. It's just giving you a little more endurance.
It sort of clears the fog, as it were.
That's exactly right. Now, at Cambridge, they are currently running a number of experiments to see what other sorts of effects that it has. And it's certainly the case that it will turn out that it will have a minor effect on something like your mathematical ability or your creative thinking. It's still early days in these studies. But all of these sorts of stimulant drugs will have some kind of measurable effect on how you think. But we're talking on the scale of tweaking and optimising, not on the scale of new capabilities just yet.
There were a lot of scaremongering stories in the media several years ago when these smart drugs first emerged, and they looked at the implications on the younger generations, those in the libraries that were cramming in the revision before exams. If this is already being prescribed to shift workers to help them deal with working through the night, should we be so concerned that people are using them during the day?
Well, I shouldn't imply that it's being prescribed to shift workers as a matter of course. People who do shift work sometimes have serious problems with disturbed sleep patterns. It's prescribed therapeutically for those reasons. But to pick up on the broader question there, look, the most popular smart drug that's out there we've been using for hundreds, if not thousands of years, is coffee and caffeine. It promotes wakefulness, it improves the success and speed that we have at performing repetitive mental tasks, data entry, and so on. And we just accept it as being a kind of regular part of human society.
I think we've more than accepted it, we've embraced it.
Well, yeah, that's right. It's the number two commodity in the world after oil.
Yes, and on the high street now, coffee shops galore. What are the side effects then? Are they similar to coffee? You've said the benefits are very similar to coffee. Same sort of symptoms and side effects?
That's right. I think that when people worry about the smart drug, they're thinking about other realms of human enhancement. And the one we always come back to is anabolic steroids in sport. And the problem with steroids is that basically an athlete will try to take as much of the drug as they can to boost their performance as much as possible, and they send themselves into realms where there are serious health side effects. But as we all know, I mean, if you keep drinking cup of coffee after cup of coffee, it will keep you awake, but at some point you're becoming jittery, you're becoming too easily distracted, you've gone past the sort of optimal balance between staying awake and being attentive and becoming nervous, anxious, feeling sick, being shaky, and all of those sorts of things.
It's interesting you drew reference to steroids because there is an ethical element to this debate. Is it right that some students take these drugs or people take them in any work sense to improve their performance? Does it give them an unfair advantage? Is it fair to compare them in that way to steroids?
Well, I think that, first of all, as long as we're bearing in mind that the effects are minor, especially when we consider that caffeine is available to all students and used by all students. So we shouldn't think that it's providing a kind of a massive benefit. But there is, of course, an ethical issue if the student who would have come, been ranked 150, is now ranked 149 by virtue of the fact that they took a drug that the other student couldn't obtain or couldn't afford. There's a kind of an issue of equity there. We want all students to have access to the same materials and methods for study, whether that's involving drinking cups of coffee, practicing really hard, studying really hard, or taking a smart pill.
There's no open questions then about possible drug testing in an academic setting.
Well, I really hope it doesn't come to that. As I said, these are sort of subtle and minor effects, and I'm not sure that it's altogether justified that we start to treat this as though it was the same as steroid use in sport. And, you know, I've often argued in interviews on other subjects that our approach to doping in sport is actually an overreaction as well.
If these drugs are being obtained by people through different channels, you know, not via a doctor, there's obviously a risk attached to that. Would regulation and changes to regulation perhaps make them safer if you're able to monitor them more?
Yeah, I'm certain that that's the case. All of the drugs that people use as smart drugs are either illegal, in the case of things like amphetamines or hallucinogens, or they're illegal to get without a prescription. And then you can never get a prescription and just for the use of enhancements. So Ritalin, Adderall, Modafinil, all of these things you need to have some sort of disorder for a doctor to be able to prescribe it for you. So it's clear that if the students are getting them in the numbers that we think that we're getting them, they're going through illicit channels one way or another.
Bennett,
and yes, that is a worry.
Bennett, thank you ever so much for that. Bennett Foddy from Oxford University.
This is Monaco 24.
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 Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Monaco 24.
This is Monaco
24. This is Monaco 24.
Esto es Monaco 24.
Esto es Monaco 24. Det
här är Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24. 24.
24. 24. Welcome back to Midori House. Now, continuing with our Meet the Neighbours series, today we headed to the local cafe, Blandford's, and heard from the owner, Jessica Colley. It's worth saying that Blandford's is the choice du jour for Monocle staff when they need a good cup of coffee. Jessica told us what made her move from Sicily to serve egg and chips in London and how she's subtly trying to change the menu.
I came to London and this was my time when probably my life changed completely, because I used to work in hospitality with my parents, so I was always involved in hospitality since I was born. Blandford's Cafe is been open since 1972. It's an heritage of this area. All people know Blanford for the breakfast, the English breakfast, the fry up. So we like this kind of historical or heritage of the place. But at the same time, we like the fact that it was in a central area and was like a good opportunity for us to create our own way of Blanford. And we are looking to change Blanford. No extreme, but we were looking to keep this heritage of breakfast, introducing some more Mediterranean style inside and more familiarity and more like personality into the place. Before it was not more like local people, officers, but we also like young people, university. So we are looking to change the menu and not the aspect, but just the menu and more like the homemade, the freshness and the healthy of the food, which is not just, I think just a normal fry up, not just I love Melbourne and I love the area, and I cannot say that the market at the moment is not. I think the crisis is affecting everybody, but it's still central, so we cannot complain as probably the others. Health is the main thing because people now they are always in rush, they don't have time, but at the same time. You can have a slice of bread with a nice olive oil and some fresh tomatoes chopped on it, and it's just something healthy, or like a vegetable soup or minestrone, which people they can. It's hard to find now because everything is frozen, everything is ready, everything is already made, and a couple of days made, and they just keep. In Sardinia, you can find the healthy and freshness of the food, which I think is going to be my key point.
That was Jessica Colley, the owner of Blandford's Cafe, speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Essa är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 dagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 är jag också.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper jalaväg.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, we're out of time for this Friday edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcos Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. In 3 hours, it's time for the Monocle Daily. That's with Andrew Muller and Tom Burgess-Watson at 2200 hours London time. They'll be asking why India wants to be friends with Iran and finding out why tuba theft is on the rise in America. Before that, though, and just after the news, Marcos Hippie presents The Menu. Headlines are next, though, right here on Monocle 24.